Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. Now, you should know how this works by now. I have a couple of pals and we have a guest. We sit around the mics and we talk stuff for about an hour. Sometimes it's really interesting and sometimes Owen's here. Today, we're starting the show light, and that isn't a reference to complexion. Kevin McPherson, aka Clav, is late. Owen, do you have anything to say about this?
Oh, this is not on, is it, really? It's unprofessional.
It's terrible. I feel a little unbalanced as there's an empty chair. I can't smell his expensive hand cream.
Yeah, or his fox covered.
Can we, while he's not here, can we talk about that?
Yeah.
What did you think of his fox coat?
I'm so confused about his fox coat. It's like, it's so luscious and luxurious, but it's not at the same time.
It's weird because when I sort of gave him what I like to call a hip-hop handshake, you know, like you slap fists and you pull in, I sort of nestled a little bit.
Did you?
In the small of his shoulder.
Did you snuggle him?
It was fucking comfy, man.
All right, when he comes, I'm going to snuggle the fox. Snuggle the fox?
All right, snuggle Kev's fox when he arrives. Jamali Maddox is our guest today. Hello, Jamali.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm upset that this dude's late. I feel disrespected as a guest.
Right?
I come all the way from East Nubja. So he's got a fox coat.
Yeah, he's got a fox.
What kind of playboys do you know that's rocking fox coats?
Wait till he arrives. You'll see, man.
Yo, is he going to wear it today?
Yeah, yeah. Probably. 100%. He always wears it.
I can't wait to see this fox coat.
He'll be wearing his leather gloves as well.
100%, because it's cold. Do you know what would be brilliant? If when he gets here, you give him almost too much of a hug and really go for the snuggle.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'll do that.
Just really
snuggling,
man. Yeah, yeah. And can I rub the back of the coat?
Yeah.
I go, is that fox? Just whisper, is that fox?
Damn, is that fox?
Could you do me a favour?
Yeah.
Rub the small of his back.
Rub the small of his back. Right. You're asking for a lot right now.
Yeah, you are.
I'm rubbing the small of
his back.
I feel like you're going to get the most enjoyment out of this. Anyway, the way you're saying it as well. And this guy said one thing. It doesn't really work on the medium of audio as well.
No, it's not.
Rub the snub of his back. That bit no one can see.
All right, I kind of gave you a bit of a
first
lame.
First, you bring me to your trap house, right? All right, I know what's going on. I'm in South London, in a trap house. All right, I know what's going on, Dad. Then you're going to start giving me some work. A couple of bricks.
Mate, hug the main guy.
Hug the main guy.
Hug the boss.
Hug the boss, you know. Rub the small of his back. That's like the code signal.
Then you're in.
Yeah,
then you're safe.
I'm in. You've got leather gloves on and everything. Yeah, it's going to be rough.
I think he's here.
Is he here?
Here he is. Mr. McPherson.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to Talk Stew.
Kevlar.
Thank you.
I'm a bit disappointed you're not wearing the fox coat. Not today.
Today's not a foxy day.
It's not a foxy day today.
If it's not a foxy day, what kind of day is it, Clav?
It's a green coat day.
I like it. It's a nice
is
scarf.
It green?
Thank you kindly.
This is weird to watch,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It is wild,
but I'm loving it. It's a great to just
stare.
He
always looks good. Kev always looks good.
Kev always.
I like the gloves.
Thank you kindly. These guys refer to them as killer gloves, but it's just
no,
cold.
They got OJ Simpson vibe to them, but they're nice gloves. But it was they're nice gloves.
No,
I can't get away with leather gloves.
No, do you know what it is? I use my hands every day for a living, and so
and they're not killer gloves.
No, they're not killer gloves.
That sounds like killer gloves.
I make music, so keeping the skin moisturized is an important thing.
And he's not joking.
No, I'm really not.
Are they full of Vaseline?
Yeah, they actually are.
Pretty much. Kev, you were late, but not late enough for us to properly introduce Jamali. Jamali, welcome to Talk Stew.
No, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm really excited to have you here because I've heard so much about you. We have a Yemi in common.
Yes. Yeah. He directed my last season of my TV show.
For anybody that follows me on social media, you'll know I have a very good friend in the shape of about 7'5" of chocolatey goodness.
Yeah, 300 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, he's just a muscle
constantly
man.
Works out.
He loves
and he
it,
doesn't
he?
Eat.
Yeah,
that's the crazy thing. This dude is like pure muscle, right? He's like big arms,
wench.
Big chest, and that wench, man. And I've seen him, and he's like maybe half a meal a day.
But he loves cake.
Yeah, he eats a lot of cake.
That's his weakness. Yeah. It's a comedy weakness. Like it's hilarious.
That's how you get him.
So like his little daughter's birthday, he bought her a massive chocolate cake,
and
of which she was too young to eat, just so he could smash it.
Yeah.
Good old Yem. Love
you. Yeah, whenever he's upset, you just go like, you go, are you right, Yemi? He goes, yeah, right. You want some cake? He goes, okay. And we give him a slice of cake and he goes, oh, I'm better now. And he hates Mexican food. Oh, it's the funniest shit. So what we would do is like, we kept saying like, so we're like, where do you want to eat? And we all voted Mexican just because we knew he didn't like it. And he'd be like, I don't like Mexican. And he would only eat like the fajita meat with rice every right. time, and he really annoyed him.
So Yemi's hilarious. So Yemi Bam is one of my closest friends, and he's the director of your show on Viceland. Now we'll get to that a little bit later on, because there's so much that I want to ask you about the series. But I'm really interested in your start in comedy, because you started out as a stand-up comedian, correct?
Yeah, I still am.
Still, what?
Yeah.
I promise I'm not saying it's done.
No, it's cool. No. I mean, you did the show,
and now your stand-up career is absolutely over.
Wait till the show comes out, it'll be over. But I started when I was about, I done my first show at 16, and it was terrible.
Jesus, that's bombed young, out. Man.
Yeah. And then I done it here and there, but I was just a bum. Just wasting my life doing nothing. Then I started taking it seriously about 20. And then I went full-time professional at about 23, 22.
See, this is the thing that I'm confused about, right? So much like yourself as a kid, I did stand-up, right?
No, I
did it once.
Yo, right? Whereabouts?
I performed at the Comedy Store.
What?
I was 13. Did you not know this?
What? You got a tape?
Yeah.
I didn't know this.
There is a tape. Listen.
When's the comeback coming?
Listen, there's no...
When's the comeback door? When's the comeback door? Regulates like you've never seen him before.
For one night only. Again. I did the Comedy Store at 13. Jonathan Ross was hosting, and it was the scariest thing in the world.
Why? Why have Jonathan Ross hosted? There's so much backstory to this.
Well, this isn't about me. We'll get into it another time. But anyhow, I did that, and I realised in that moment, when I walked on stage and the applause sort of stopped, it was like, holy shit, this is real. I've got to now talk to this room. I imagine for a lot of people, that first comedy gig is the one that either makes you go, do you know what? I want to go through this pain and suffering again, or they get lucky and it goes well. Your first time was bad, right?
Terrible.
And why did you go back?
So I loved it.
Really?
I didn't. It was a weird feeling, right? And I bombed a lot. Like, I've had a lot of bombs. Like, I've
just for the record, things not to say with that beard.
Yeah. Especially on the plane. But like I've had a lot of bad shows. But I remember this is the first gig. I just loved it. I just didn't. The cause and effect of what happened didn't bother me. I felt free within that moment, and I remember that feeling because I never felt free in my life. I always felt really boxed in. I didn't know what that boxing in was. But then when I went on stage, it sort of went away, and I felt calm. For a second, even though there was chaos, I felt calm within that, and I just from then I was always obsessed with it. And then when I started taking it seriously, when I started taking the art form seriously, I started, you know, realizing what that feeling was.
So, what is that taking of it? Because I'm a huge fan of comedy. If there's a new hour, I'm watching it. I'm obsessed with so many comedians. Yeah. I love comedians in cars drinking coffee because I'm just fascinated by the comedian mind and how you assess and see the world. And this idea of you realizing that you're actually getting good at it came from what? A good gig, or you actually writing a bit and saying, you know what?
Yeah.
That stands up.
Do you know what? Funny. The first bit I wrote that I knew the tide was changing in terms of my creativity in doing comedy was I wrote this whole routine about the London riots.
Okay.
And so that shows when, was that 2012?
Fairly recent.
Yeah. So it was the London riots, and it was that routine of talking about the London riots that I knew that I was hitting a point in my comedy. I think it came from probably being honest. And it sounds like cliche, but it's hard to be honest.
You say that, I would argue, and I'd say it's perspective. Because if you look at the comedy landscape, you've got this pocket of black comedians who sort of play the same rooms and play to the same audiences. And then you've got this mainstream thing that's going on where you've got similar faces with similar perspectives. And then you've got people like you who can bounce between either and is able to talk to a very broad audience about a very specific experience. So I think your perspective in that environment is probably why it hit more. Would you agree?
No, obviously there's elements of that, of like I'm telling an outside perspective, so the story is interesting to those people. Because I was saying to mainstream rooms, I never really came up on the black circuit.
Yeah.
I never really played them. So it was like, and I kind of preferred it in a way because I was an outsider looking in as opposed to the insider looking out. I'm saying like, look what we do. I kind of always, my style has always been of, this is what I do and I see what you guys are doing. Does that make sense?
So I've always played the mainstream, but it's sort of blending in together now, thankfully, because I think people are sort of jumping over and stuff like that. But I think you can't negate the how important honesty is to it, because you know, you just giving your perspective is not enough. You have to say how you really feel about that, and that's hard.
Have you ever faced any challenge from an audience, not a heckler, but in delivering your honest perspective on something?
Oh yeah, I've been called racist, misogynistic.
Really?
I've been called all types. Yeah, I got called racist a lot. I remember one time I was doing this gig, and it was in this pub, and the pub looked like a living room, right? And it was like it was six people in the pub, right? And everyone had no teeth and shit, and it was mad, and it was just really weird. And I was on stage, and I was doing these jokes. And one guy went, you're a fucking racist. I went, I'm half white. And he went, oh yeah. And that was it. And I got called a misogynist in Edinburgh. And I got called a misogynist by this girl called me a misogynist. And it was a pro-feminist bit. But in the joke, I'm trying to say that, look, you understand, for my people, my community, for me to associate with them, sometimes I got to use words like pussy and tits. That's how I get to them. You know what I'm saying? I can't use your words. And your words are fine for you, but not for me.
Right.
And she started calling me misogynist. I said, it's not that you think I'm a misogynist. It's that you think that only middle-class white people can have a certain amount of perspective, and you think I'm stupid.
Right.
And you don't think I understand irony, and you don't think I'm layered.
Mm.
I said, that's the issue right now. It's not because you think I'm a misogynist. It's because if Stuart Lee or Daniel Kitson done this, you go, oh my God, he's a genius. Right. Because it's me, you're like, you're an idiot. You don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the debt that comes with honesty.
Yeah.
People are going to come at you like that. So
how is your racial ambiguity? And I say that completely from my perspective.
No one knows where the fuck I'm from.
Yeah. How is that played? Knows. Has that played for or against you? Because for anybody that doesn't know what Jamali looks like, how would you describe your appearance?
I look like every race that every country hates. I could look like anything that they hate. So if I go Holland, I'm Moroccan. You know, if I go to Israel, I'm from Palestine. If I go Palestine, I'm from Israel. Like, I look like everything, really. But I try not to use it too much, you know.
But you do use it in bits.
Yeah, I have done.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know if I'm trying to kind of move away from that now.
Right.
Because I think it's kind of easy.
And how much has that played into the show that you're making?
Oh, yeah. It's played into that more.
All right. Hate Thy Neighbour is a show that you front on Viceland, which is a cable channel started by the people behind Vice. And for anybody that's read Vice magazine, you know how they operate and the sorts of territories that they like to tackle. And my first interaction with Vice as a content provider really was on YouTube, and it grew from YouTube to Viceland TV, which is what is now
the YouTube
worldwide.
Stuff was great. Yeah,
the YouTube stuff was amazing. What was it? My favorite was
the Liberia documentary, and
I saw all of that. Yeah. But the cannibal one.
Oh yeah, Japanese cannibal.
No, a General Butt Naked.
Oh yeah, that's the Liberia one.
It is.
For anyone that hasn't seen,
it sounds ridiculous.
Wait.
man.
Wait. General Butt Naked.
And you, trust me, it's the type of guy where if you met him and he said, my name's General Butt Naked, you go, fair enough, sir.
Yes, okay.
And shake his hand, he's a fucking nutter.
General Butt Naked is about cannibalism.
General Butt Naked would go into war naked, correct?
Yeah, well, basically, it was about when there was like a civil war in Liberia, and there was different war generals, and there was one war general, they called themselves different names. One would call himself Bin Laden, the other called himself the Mosquito, and this guy was General Butt Naked. And he would go into war naked, but they also believed in witchcraft. So they would eat people and eat hearts and eat baby hearts and that. He was a really gnarly guy. And he got pulled up on war charges.
Yeah.
And then he got exonerated on the war charges because he became a preacher.
Just that's it.
Yeah. So they're like, you're a preacher, so.
Wait, you went and met him?
No.
Now you're talking crazy.
Yeah, now you took some crazy shit. I've done some crazy stuff. I ain't mean that guy.
See, you found factual in a really interesting way, because somebody like myself who has ended up making documentaries, coming from the world that I've come from of music and entertainment, that just shouldn't really happen. And you've delivered, I guess, edgy comedy for years. You've offended people. And you've also won a lot of fans in the process. And that has led you to factual. So how do you go from being at Edinburgh doing one-man shows at the Soho Theatre to suddenly having a show on Viceland?
I always wanted to make docs. Like, even when I was doing the comedy thing, I always had it in the back of my head, like, I want to kind of, like, because I watched, like, Louis Theroux or Nick Broomfield. Like, Nick Broomfield's an underrated motherfucker. When people was doing my doc, like, Louis the dude. Louis is my favourite.
I call him right. He's the god MC.
Yeah, he's the best. He's Louis is the dude. But Nick Broomfield's a bad dude. Like,
he boomed himself.
Yeah.
He carried his own mic.
He boomed himself. Plus doing interviews.
He's
amazing.
And it's just some of them, like, you know, he done the Biggie and Tupac one, the, you know, watching all those.
Kurt and Courtney,
the one where he does in South Africa with the racist guy. Yeah. The driver, the leader, and his wife, which is one of my favorite films. But yeah, so I was watching them dudes. I always wanted to make a film, but I knew that like it was going to be hard for me to make a film like that without putting comedy into it. So I pitched the idea of me basically going around the world and talking to far right wing extremists and doing comedy in between it. And they took the show, and then we ran with it.
So what was the initial reaction?
It was a weird mix. Like, some people really liked it. And some people really hated it. But the people that normally hated it were Nazis.
Funny that.
Yeah, I got like a lot of death threats from it and stuff like that. And, you know, it sort of like, it was this like, because it was the one episode, because I made six in the first season. And there was one that really stood out, and it was about neo-Nazis. And it was when I met this guy called Dan Burnside. And it was just because he was such a complex character, because he was he was a decent dude, but he was just a Nazi. And he was kind and funny and all these type of attributes,
yeah.
But just were a Nazi teacher and had horrific views. It was complicated for people.
Yeah.
And it was like, they sort of, yeah. So, you're
saying. So I was going to say, it's fascinating. And I'm glad that you've kind of said what you've said, in the sense that often I think people will look at these guys and sort of assume that they're all monsters and forget that they're actually human beings.
Mm.
And even if your views are diametrically opposed to them,
yeah.
It's like, as you said, he's a funny guy, or he might be a family man. Or it's like, okay, what you are about, in no way will I ever subscribe to.
No.
But the fact that you are even able to have a dialogue.
Yeah.
It's like, that to me is something that I have to respect. Because I think it's very easy to write people off sometimes.
I think, but it's always like, we've done that for so long, of just be like, I don't, and let's take it away from Nazism, because Nazism is a very extreme ideology, just in terms of Labour and Conservative. You know, we were so just like, I don't want to hear your point of view, you don't want to hear my, and we just sort of separate so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to do something different. And I did want to, and I wanted to make a show where I didn't just go around the world and say, you're wrong. Do you know what I mean? Just point my finger and go, because the thing is, like, do I have a moral high ground? Yes, because I don't believe we should kill all the Jews. So I'm sorry, my moral high ground is higher than yours, you know? But I'm not proving anything by saying that. I'm not proving anything by me just going, exactly. And I wanted to actually have a, and see why.
See, I really wanted to ask you this question because what you're saying speaks massively to what I've experienced, but I had to learn it on camera. Because to begin with, I would get annoyed and it would get in the way of the interview. And the minute I was able to get over that, I think I got better in the factual space.
Mm.
Were you able to start being calm and objective, or did you at any points find yourself losing your rag a bit with the people that you were meeting?
There was times I lost my rag with people, 100%.
Give us an example.
What's a good example of one? There's one that I don't want to talk about. But there's
what's her name?
Yeah, okay, I'll tell you this one. They say, well, I was at, so basically I went to it was that's funny. But I went to a Ku Klux Klan bar. And they were having as you do, you know, it's a Saturday night. So I went to a Ku Klux Klan bar.
Can we paint the picture a bit? Okay. All right, so what were you wearing?
Okay, me, I was wearing,
are we? What country are
I'm
we?
In Georgia, in
Deep South.
Right. And there's a Ku Klux Klan bar. And basically, I'm with this neo-Nazi who's the leader of the NSM. And we go to a bar, and they're doing a swastika and a cross burning. What they've done is they've got a coalition with all the white power groups. Have joined in this coalition, and they're having a meeting and they're having a wedding there. So the guy that we're with, Jeff Scooper, said to us, look, we can get you into the Klan bar. I said, cool. So I get there. All the other racist groups have said, he can't go in because of the color of my skin. I'm not allowed in. Little did they know all of my camera crew were Jewish, but that's another story.
Whoa.
Right? And so they were all inside, which is ironic. And so I'm there, right? And they're not letting me in, and the guy's coming over and he's trying to explain to me, and I'm winding him up on purpose. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm just winding him up on purpose. I'm like, well, how far can I go? If I do come inside, how far can I go? I'm just purposely winding him up. And so then we talk outside, and it's the only time that I'm in this Klan bar, and basically, it bad judgment on someone's part, but I'm not going to put him under the bus because it's a stressful situation. But they've said now that I can go inside the Klan bar after the event's done. And I remember just saying to one of the crew members, I said, I'm not going inside. And she was like, why? We've got to do the interview. And I said, I'm going to be honest with you. If I'm not good enough then, I'm not good enough now.
Mm.
I ain't going inside that fucking Klan bar. If they want to finish the interview, they can come outside. I ain't going inside that motherfucker. Because if I go inside that motherfucker, I'm going to try and burn that bitch down. See what I'm saying? Like, we ain't doing this. Right? So then the guys come outside and we're sort of talking and I'm purposely winding him up. And that was the one point where I was like, all right, I've got to stop here because I'm being unprofessional and I'm sort of getting to a point with this person where I'm letting him get to me.
Mm.
Do you know what I'm saying? And even though I'm winning this right now, because he's the one getting wound up and I'm funnier than him, I'm smarter than this guy. So I can just, you know, I know what to say to him today. I know all these buttons already. I've seen it. I've seen him in hecklers. I can see your buttons. Do you know what I'm saying? I can see that you don't like that about yourself. So I'm going to talk about that.
Mm.
And I can see that. And, you know, and it didn't make it into the film, but I saw myself purposely trying to wind this guy up.
See, on the flip side, though, I saw a clip of you with, I think he was an EDL guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that he wasn't racist.
Mm.
But he was saying the most racist things in the world. Can you sort of reiterate some of the things that he was saying?
Yeah, but it's okay. Yeah, that was the lot. That's what.
But you were good. You were just confused. You didn't get angry with him.
Yeah, we tried to fight me after as well.
Oh, there is that. Okay.
And then we see that was the weird one because I've never spoke about this either, and it's kind of hard to talk about. But so we're having this conversation, and the whole time we're shooting with him, you got to hear the backstory. The whole time we're shooting with him, there's this sort of weird. Like, I've kept on telling him, I don't agree with your views, but he's not listening. You know, he's not listening to that. He's just in his own world of this, what's going on right now. And he sort of built this relationship in his head. And so we go to film and then it comes to the end bit where I've got to talk to him about his views and give him my point of view a bit more in depth. And I'm talking to him and basically what he's saying is, I said to him, how can you believe, you know, so you're telling me that you don't care about little kids who want to come to England for a better life. He goes, no, I don't give a fuck about them. And I go, why? And he goes, you know, why should I? They need to look after English people. I'm English. They should look after me. And he goes, you know, they come here and they don't bring nothing to this country. They don't help this country. I go, do you honestly believe you help this country? Like, do you give anything to this country? And he goes, no. And that was, awkward. And you could tell that I got him there, you know, and then you could see he got really upset. And then he tried to fight me after, and I was, and this was like the last filming day of all of the stuff I've seen throughout these six episodes. This is like literally the last day I'm filming, and he's come at me, always, you know, trying to fight me, and I've took off my jacket, and then my sound guy has just put his hand on my chest, and he goes, what the fuck are you doing, you know, and it really woke me up, and I realized in that moment that if I hit him, I wasn't hitting him because I was angry at him. I'm hitting him because I'm angry at six episodes. I've just heard shit. Do you see what I'm saying, though? And plus, I'm at a rally and I've got a crew with me. And if I start a fight with this guy, I'm putting my whole crew in danger.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like, you know, you have to really swallow your pride on that one. And that was hard. But at the same time, it was like, that was like the hardest moment for me. It was like, and I really had to take a look at what films I was making. And, you know, it was a real reflection moment for me to really know what I'm doing.
I feel like I'm being really selfish here because I'm hearing so many things that I felt.
Because I'm saying this
difficult situation.
I was talking about this with Yemi, the director.
Yeah,
because it's weird when you come back from making these type of films, as you know already. I've seen your films, man. You saw some gnarly shit too, and it's weird when you come back and people want to know everything about it, and you can't explain what you saw. Just what I'm saying though, and you have to keep that. And I said it to some of my crew members, I said, there's no point talking about it.
Right.
They will never understand what you saw.
My line is always, just watch the show.
But even on the show, I don't, you know, it's because it's, yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. I think, you know, you're maturer than me in that respect to see the bigger picture. But I don't know. It's just like, it's you see some bad things, you know, and you kind of have to, it's hard to try and analyze that type of stuff.
How do you sort of decompress when you get back from a very difficult series or a shoot? Because as you said, it stacks up.
Film on film,
it gets hard.
Yeah.
And I've actually gone out of my way to ensure that this year I'm doing some lighter stuff because I need to laugh.
You need to do that.
Because it's heavy. Yeah. But how do you stop yourself from spiraling?
It's weird because my whole YouTube becomes it. Because it made me have a big, better perspective on what the racist people or people with extreme ideas sort of how they get into this mess, right? Because what happens is it happened to my YouTube because I'm researching for the shows, is all of my YouTube suggestions become that. All of my Facebook becomes that. Everything becomes that. And it becomes, because it's targeted marketing. So what happens is you get into this fucking echo chamber and you think of all these, that's all they're watching. Yeah. All they're watching is far right wing talks. All they're watching is this, it's madness. And so I really had to, like, you know, shut all that shit off my YouTube, cut all that stuff off my Facebook, you know what I'm saying? Trying not to come offline for a bit, you know what I'm saying? No more Instagram.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's hard to come off the gram too, you know what I'm saying?
Does that go both ways though, do you think?
Yeah, 100%. And my criticism goes to the left as well. I mean, it's not, I think that's another, I mean, I'm only talking about the right specifically because that's where a lot of my films, and it's weird because I wanted to make films about the left. Mm. I wanted to make a film this season about sort of safe space culture in the university campuses. So I find that shit fascinating, safe space culture. And that's a very left-wing idea. Because that's the one thing that people say, you know, I get called a sort of social justice warrior. When I criticize the left as well, you know, it's like my criticism goes both ways.
Yeah.
I don't like madness.
Well, why do you think that you've not sort of gone into different territory then outside of factual? Is that something you aim to do?
No, I just kind of like factual. And I kind of haven't done what I wanted to do yet with it. Mm. So I think I might.
Which is what?
I kind of...
Do the Wu-Tang doc thing.
Yeah, mate, I love the fucking Wu, you know that.
You want to do a Wu-Tang doc?
Oh, I'd love to.
I'm
in.
I'll do
the boom or whatever.
Boom, we got it. We just had to pitch me in, that's what this was.
Listen, Wu-Tang
Who's your favourite member?
Listen, some people ask me who's my favourite rapper, right, in general.
Yeah.
I don't even know who my favourite rapper in Wu-Tang is. Like, let alone in the world.
It's such a hard question, isn't it?
I don't know. There's so many personalities.
How did you find the Wu-Tang? Because I have to speak about it like it's a religion, because it kind of is.
It is.
I know that you two could just go off for an hour about this and make this the Wu show.
But it's specific.
Send it to Viceland.
Exactly. Cut me out. But then there's this, we all have these moments where we connected to the Wu in some weird sort of way. I saw the symbol first.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I just see people wearing jumpers and I'd read the source and I'd be like, what's that? And then I heard records. And as a kid, you know, you sort of like read your uncle's magazines or whatever. And I think it was the skits on 36 Chambers that got me in, that made me go, okay, this is something else. This isn't like anything I've ever heard. And I was like, I'm going to unravel a hanger and stick crazy.
Oh, yeah, the Method Man.
I was like, what the fuck is this? So like, what was the thing that made you go, okay, this is different, this is me, this is a religion, I'm in?
MTV late night, I think it was Raw, where they would show the nudie vids.
Amazing.
You know, the MTV nudie vids where they have the Nelly with the credit card through the bumhole and shit. and they played Triumph.
Ooh.
And I just remember hearing Inspector Dex, I Rhyme Atomically, Socrates, Philosophies and Hypotheses. I remember hearing that and just going, what the fuck? Just like, blow, and there's motherfuckers turning into bees and shit. I was just like, yo.
There's no chorus, it's just fucking,
and it's just lyrics and bars. And it's just, and then Method Man, and this is like one of my favorite lyrics ever. It's just, the iron lung ain't got to tell you where it's coming from.
Just,
I remember this, and I just seeing that, and it's just changing all of my, like, hip hop taste. From then it was pure boom bap. Like all I like is bars.
What is it about East Coast rap in that era that does something to people?
Because the thing is, like, I'm not like, I think, you know, I think LA rap is cool and all that West Coast hyphy stuff. I like listening to it and G-Funk, but I'm not, you know, I don't live in the sun. You know what I'm saying? I'm not like rolling down the street in my shorts and, hey man, smoking blunts. Like I'm not living that type of life where like I think New York rap has more of a like the city
thing.
Yeah,
to it.
But it sounds like New York. I was in the States for work a couple years ago, and for the first time, New York hip hop, when you listen to it in New York, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because there's tall buildings and it's kind of cramped and it's cold at times and it's a bit more sort of like edgy. And then you go to LA and you listen to whatever, you know, like
DJ
Dre
or
Cypress Hill, and everything's flat and low.
It's driving music, you can't walk nowhere in LA.
And it's
either,
hot,
it?
And it's slower.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It makes sense more.
When did Wu-Tang slap you in the face?
I remember this specific moment. I was at the dentist, right?
And you got some cheap dentist.
The best stories, you know. Best stories, this guy.
I was at the dentist with my mum, right? And in the waiting room, you know they always have magazines?
Yeah.
Always shit magazines. And so I was just bored, like obviously scared of the dentist.
How old are you at this point?
I must have been 10, 11. And I was looking through the magazine and all of a sudden there was a picture of a car on fire, and all nine Wu members in front of it, just And I'm not joking. I was scared. I got scared from a picture. I was like, oh my God. Like, thank God my mum's here. And I remember seeing it and I remember reading a little bit of Wu-Tang, but I turned the page, I was frightened, right? And then my friends that were into kind of Nirvana and grunge were also into Wu.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't really my hip-hop friends or their older brothers, should I say, really, because we were young. That were into Woo. It was the kind of grunge kids that showed me Grave Diggers.
Yeah.
And then Woo, 36 Chambers. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, okay, forget it. This is it. This is
all I wanted was a pair of Wu-Tang Wannabes.
Yeah, me too.
And I tried to find them as well. You can't find them nowhere, but I want a pair of them Wu-Tang.
Because it was
bad.
A thing, wasn't it? It felt like you had to dress a certain way, walk a certain way. Like, they were the first people that I saw wearing do-rags, and I was like, I want to wear a do-rag, I don't even want waves. I just want to wear one. Like, everything about them felt like a thing. It felt like a
And they
a
had
movement.
Like the Wu Mansion and that, they had all these like
Yeah,
weird...
the pool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, what? These guys
they had
are
the
fucking
Wu-Tang pool, fam.
Crazy.
Do you know how many people I've seen with Wu-Tang tattoos?
Really?
I've seen people with Wu-Tang tattoos on their face.
Oh my God.
I saw a girl in Rotterdam. I was doing a comedy festival and this girl who was like one of the hosts had a Wu-Tang tattoo on her neck.
Wow.
And I was like, you're a big Wu-Tang fan? She goes, nah. And I go, why did you have that? She goes, it was just a symbol that she saw a lot as a kid. Do you know what I'm saying, though?
Wow.
It was just that symbol.
That's ridiculous.
So it wasn't, she was like, yeah, I like
really
the music.
Stupid.
And yeah, ridiculous. But it just shows to show that symbol was, because I mean, that's graffiti. That was graffitied everywhere, and it's such a powerful.
I remember I traveled to Belgium to see them. I drove to Belgium.
Really? I didn't know that.
That's a pilgrimage.
Yeah. We went to this festival, right? And it was Wu-Tang, DJ Shadow, RJD2, and also a bunch of like drum and bass DJs, basically. Yeah. We got there and it was just dudes just everywhere, wall to wall Serbian guys. Yeah. And the only booze you could buy was Stella Artois. So everyone was like tanked up on this like Stella and wanted to like fuck everyone up and listen to drum bass. So we were kind of dodging, but we saw Wu and Ghostface was just like, my fucking, he was just like, yo, bonjour. Like, world famous Belgian waffles, yo.
So I was talking about Italian pasta and shit. He's got crazy. Like, angel hair pasta. I don't know where that is, but I'm with it, brother.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever see anything like that again? In terms of a movement, a moment, do you think technology has changed the way that we consume music in a way that kind of thing just can't happen?
Had a similar,
it felt like that at the beginning,
didn't
it?
Had a similar thing at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I think Wu, you just kind of, you wanted to be their friends. You wanted, well, not necessarily, I was terrified of them, but you wanted to like know more about them. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You're intrigued. And Odd Future had that kind of intrigue about
them. Yeah, Odd Future were dope, man. Odd Future had bull energy. I remember that there was that one, when I thought that Odd Future were going to be huge and fucking massive, is when I saw them when they done that Camden show. What's that Camden show? Where they got everyone to riot.
Oh my God.
Like, run on the stage and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? It was, what's it called? The crew. Camden crew.
Yeah.
They performed at Camden crew and they just got everyone to bum rush the stage.
And Tyler was up on
the speaker. Tyler was up on the speaker and then they were like, fuck the security, bum rush the stage. And he's got all these crazy white kids running around with it, dancing on the stage.
It was the moment when I saw Tyler swallow the cockroach in the video.
Yeah.
That I was like, this is punk now. This is something else. This is going somewhere else. Yeah, that was.
Do you feel like it went somewhere else? Do you feel like they ever did?
It's weird because they're now more successful than any collective out there. Like, Odd Future is Frank Ocean, it's Sid the Kid, it's the internet, it's Tyler. They're massive when you think about it.
L Sweatshirt.
Yeah, L Sweatshirt, exactly.
He's dope.
They're
he
is the best. Massive, but it doesn't feel like they're...
Doesn't feel like Wu,
they're
though.
Together in the does same
it?
Way.
It doesn't, and it doesn't feel like... It doesn't feel like that they're creating a movement anymore. It feels like the movement is dead. Okay, they're successful now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying, though? Yeah. Like, it doesn't feel like the... And it's no diss to them. I think that's what success does. But it's just, it kind of stumped.
Do you think we'll see it again, Kev?
No. I hate to say no.
In a word, no.
Nah. No, I don't believe so. Partly because, and I've spoken on this before. Like, I think there's a certain homogeneity that's happened in music.
That's a 10-point word, bro.
And, yeah, I know.
Homogeneity.
So, essentially what I'm saying is that with the Wu and all their precursors, so Public Enemy, right, you can see there is a sound that comes from New York.
The lineage,
right? There was a sound that came from the South. There was a sound that came from the Midwest. There was a sound that came from the West. And what I hear now is a lot of homogeneity. And I mean that in the sense that even down to the choices of sounds and how they're used... Mm. it's very much the same. Mm. Whereas I feel like in that era, or up and maybe what we would, I guess we'd call the golden era, it was very, people were very distinctive. Mm. So people from Philly didn't sound like guys from New York. Mm. They didn't sound like guys from Florida, who didn't sound like guys from, I don't know, Milwaukee, who didn't sound like guys from the West
saying
Coast.
That, I know what you're saying, but for me, I didn't feel like Wu sounded like Biggie.
No, but this is what I'm saying.
They're both New York.
But this is the point. No, they are New York. But what I'm saying, even within New York, they were sounds. Mm. It's not just, I mean, you could break it down by borough.
Mm. Yeah.
So
yeah,
the thing of it is now, it's like, there's a, what I seem to hear anyway, maybe I'm out of touch, but I hear like, there's a certain sameness to stuff.
That type of shit, like mumble rap.
Not even, no. I'm not even talking about the rapping. I'm saying even in terms of the sonics and the music. Like Wu's sound is their sound.
Yeah, it's forget the rap from it.
Just the sounds that they were using. Mm. The same way Public Enemy and Hank Shockley. What those guys did.
Yeah, different.
It's like, no one wanted to do what they did.
I heard a story that, and this might not be true, but I heard that someone approached Wu to put their record out and they said no. Mm-hmm. And then, I can't remember what label it was. It might have been BMG, but I'm not 100% on that. And then they said, look, here's blah, blah, money, come on, we really want to sign you, blah, blah. And then RZA said, okay, you can put it out, but it goes out like this. It, no remaster or no like new mixes. Like, because they were selling it out of their cars, weren't they?
Yeah,
like
on the fruit.
And they said 36 Chambers goes out like this. If you want it, it goes out like this. And that's why it kind of sounds
raw.
Yeah,
that's something that's happened. If you know, and only from going to New York back maybe around the turn of about 2000, I remember meeting a couple of A&Rs, and some of the stories they've told me in relation to these sort of hip hop legends that you hear of, guys were really about that life. Like, and I don't mean in the sense of the gangster thing. Like, the music was more important than the money. Whereas now, it's
a very different thing.
It's about the money.
Like, yeah, well, I guess it's like with any type of showbiz, is that when there becomes a path of like, okay, this is what you can get. So you can, YouTube, SoundCloud, this is what you can get now. It becomes a part, a career path, as opposed to I'm making music because I have to.
But it's not, that. I'm saying even in terms of integrity, like, you know, if I think of someone like, I don't know, Tribe Called Quest, did they ever change or sell out for money?
No, but
if you know, if you know,
but their sound was selling. So
No. I agree with that. But everyone has their peak and their off peak. Mm. So it's very easy sometimes for people to chase whatever is popular in the attempt of making more money. Mm. Whereas I feel like nowadays people are more likely to do that. Where back in the day, people were like, "No, I'm not having it." So your story in terms of RZA saying, "I'm not changing. I don't care if you think it's grimy and raw. Mm. That's how it's going out." Mm. That wouldn't happen now. Yeah. If there's an A&R saying, "Look, if you let us do what we do, there's 3 million on the table." Mm. How many of these guys coming up are going to turn?
I'll take half.
But this is the point I'm making.
But they've made more than 3 million. It's the long game you've got to.
I know, exactly.
But then it's like, did they even see that long game? Were they even visionary? I don't think it was going to pop did?
I think all of those guys, and that's the kind of mindset I'm saying, all of those guys were doing what they did in the truest sense of the word, being an artist. Yeah. Mm.
When's the last time that you felt like you heard a movement in music? I think the last time I felt where I was like, yo, this is a thing, is when I heard Lethal Be Power, the original version.
It's grime.
And it's grime, but it was that song in particular when I felt, because grime in the culture, I think grime kind of, we didn't appreciate how much of a culture we had. Mm. And we kind
to
of,
begin with. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it was it's a culture, you know, and we kind of heard it as a music, but that's another story.
I don't think that, particularly through the UK lens, I don't think there has been anything ever. Yeah. As impactful as that will go on to become. Because I don't really think it's really peaked yet.
But I remember hearing POW. Yeah. And I'm seeing the reaction. I went to Rampage Carnival with my older cousin.
They banned it at Carnival.
And they banned it. And I was there when they rioted.
Yeah.
And I remember that people were ripping tree branches and smashing cars. And all I heard was the policeman just say, "Someone turn off the music." And people just smashing shit. And the DJ's just reloading it. It's just, all you heard was bunk. Boom, boom.
About that record and the energy that record has.
People smash toilets up.
Still, it encapsulates a moment though. Yeah. That record. Do you ever put any sort of hip hop or grime stuff in your acts? Do you ever talk about it?
No, not really. You know, I've never. It's a weird thing. It's like even though it was like a big part of my youth growing up, it wasn't enough. Like, I sort of talk about, I'll talk about music and stuff, but I won't do like you know, anyone remember this song? Like, I actually did a show last night and I made a really niche music reference and more people got it than there was. There was this guy wearing like, you know, the hats with the flaps.
Oh, right,
and I said, yeah, take it off. Who are you? Pay as you go crew. Right? But I was just like,
had that. It was a Nike hat. It was in blue and black.
And then
the flaps that you could velcro on.
It was that exact hat.
And the peak.
And I just started talking about pay as you go versus Heartless Crew. And it was like a really niche reference, but like more
they
people got it.
They don't want to hear you. Come off the stage.
Credit done.
And then, legendary.
So I'll do like a little niche music reference and stuff like that, but I don't do the whole like anyone remember this song and play the song and then do the dance to it.
Who do you look at then in terms of comedians that you go, you know what, they're inspiring me, they're shaping me?
Patrice O'Neill.
I agree fully.
Ever did it, like, that guy's honesty was brutal. Richard Pryor, of course. I always watched American comedians because there was no one like me on TV doing jokes in England. Do you know what I'm saying? It was like, you know, even though like as a comedian with a comedy mind, I understand comedy. So I can watch a comedian and understand what he's saying, even though I don't relate to it. Does that make sense? Like, I can get what he's saying. So all this British comedy I was watching and stuff, and I understood what they were doing, but it didn't resonate. And then watching Dave Chappelle, the first comedian I watched that blew my fucking mind, I was at my dad's house and I was watching the 100 Greatest Comedians on Channel 4. And I remember watching him going, he's all right. And Bill Hicks came on. And my mind was just like, I just remember watching it and going like, yo, there's a guy. Because I remember I felt weird. Because I had ideas and my friends, like, you know, God bless them, man. But, you know, they were sort of like, it was sort of very much like, all we spoke about was like, you know, money and pussy and trainers. Like, that was... That was our experience.
In that
but
order.
But then I just kind of didn't want to, you know, I had other things, and then Bill Hicks came on. I was like, yo, this guy's like, that shit was crazy.
It was his truth.
It was
and
his
that
truth.
Was the thing. And
I remember
was
showing
so
people
passionate.
And people be like, well, I don't get it. And I go, oh, this isn't for everyone.
Yes.
And that kind of learned me a lesson. Like, this ain't for everyone. And I fucking love Bill Hicks.
Do you think that sort of humor's coming back? Because it feels as though Chappelle was very much standing.
Oh, that lot,
on
them
the
last
shoulders
two specials,
of,
boy. Woo!
Yeah. We've spoken about this before. Kevin and I watched those together and we were laughing, and I was thinking, while I was watching it, I know this is going to piss a lot of people off, but I kind of like the fact that he knows that too.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is what it is. I mean, you don't really get many comedians that are brave enough to do that now.
No, you do. You do. They're out there. Oh, no, they're out there. All but right. It's just if they get put on.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, and it's that weird thing now of how we even consume comedy has changed. You know, a lot of people at the comedy clubs. Hmm. Not a lot of people at the, you know, there's so many comedians out there that are just saying, you know, not even just gnarly shit, but just honest, truthful, good comedy with an opinion. You got like Alfie Brown, you got, you know, Finn Taylor, you got a couple other bubs, you got Dane Baptiste, you got like a load of comedians out there, you know, but it's just how people are consuming it. It's different. Like, no one ain't going to the comedy clubs no more, really, as much as they used to. Everyone's watching Netflix and or watching TV and how they get put on.
Is that the new Holy Grail now, the Netflix hour? Because it was the HBO hour for years, wasn't it? It was like, oh yeah, Chris Rock got an HBO special.
Yeah,
oh,
I think Netflix is like, you know, someone gets a Netflix deal, you go, damn. You know what I'm saying? Like, yo, that's like, you know, one of my boys got a Netflix deal, like, you're happy for that dude, you know what I'm saying? That's like the thing, you know, I think that's kind of our... It used to be Live the Apollo in England.
Yeah.
You know, Live the Apollo was the thing. That was a star maker. You know what I'm saying? Mm. That was like the thing to do.
Yeah, just ask Michael McIntyre's bank manager.
Yeah. It's like, you know, Kevin Bridges or pardon me, all of them cats, you know? But I think Netflix is that now. But, you know, to answer your question, I think now people want something a little bit more opinionated. I think that's coming back.
Why has that shift happened?
Because the world's getting crazy. And I think we kind of, and it's a weird thing now, really, is, and I don't know why it is, but there is that thing of, and you look at the Dave Chappelle special, is he's a comedian. He's not a politician. He's not a TED talk. It's a comedy show. But people are taking his opinion so seriously. Mm. And it's that weird shift of like, comedians have become sort of the moral truths now. Like in a weird
way.
Pryor
and all the guys.
Okay, to a point. Do you know what I'm saying? But now it's sort of like, there was no Pryor. You know, Pryor didn't have write-ups in The Guardian. Like, did you hear what he said?
Oh, no, because he was
saying?
Yeah. But
like,
you
had Lenny Bruce and you had all these old truth guys. But it's just like, it's a weird thing of like, now people are really, and it's like, I think the art form's getting taken seriously more now. But then at the same time, that has its debt as well. Because when people take things too seriously, it kind of negates the art form a bit.
Agreed.
But
Is the America thing on your radar? Is that something that you care about? Because obviously in music, everybody wants to conquer the States. In film, it's the same thing. Is it the same in comedy? Or does it not matter?
I mean, it happens. No. There is definitely like people aspire for America.
I'm talking about you.
No. Fuck shit. Man, you know, I tried to slip my way out.
Yeah, you
not
did.
No, Reggie Yates, boy. Yeah, fuck around. I tried to it's a hard one. Yes. Yeah. Because I've been out there. And I've had a couple meetings and shit, and it's like you kind of feel like there's more opportunity out there. And I kind of feel like, you know, like I kind of do want to go out there. Like, and it's weird, especially, I don't know, it's a weird one because with my show, it's got a big viewership in America, so I can tour in America.
Of course, so Viceland is international,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so that's a weird feeling now that I can, like, you know, tour in America, which I will be doing this year if my visa comes through.
I don't know why I'm laughing at it. I'm sorry.
Mate, you should laugh, because if I don't laugh, I'll cry about it.
I've just heard a lot of African uncles say that to me over the years. Yeah, I'll see my wife again if the visa comes to me. I've not heard much else.
But I'm definitely going to be out there more than that. Like, it's definitely something I want to do. But I'm not, you know, I like England, you know, as well.
So how do American audiences react to the show? Because I'm sure you're hearing through social media what they think about Hate Thy Neighbor.
Yeah, I think they react. I think they react just as the same as English people. It's weird because I don't think my show's changing anyone's mind. I don't think anyone who was racist watched that show and go, "I'm not racist now." It's kind of people who weren't racist before and kind of wanted to see something like that. And but yeah, I don't know. It was more. I think their reactions are pretty good over there. You know, like I'm sort of like most of my fan base is out there now.
Yeah. Do you guys watch much Viceland? Have you seen much on there?
It's fine.
Why do you look so angry at the film? I don't watch Vice.
Yeah. No, I just, I don't know. I'm just, I don't have time really to.
That Tash says that you should work in the office.
Yeah, he would fit. He would blend in like deep.
What, the Vice Land office?
Reeboks as well.
Yeah, the dirty Reeboks. Yeah.
No, you'd blend in.
Dirty Reeboks.
Well, they're a bit grimy.
Well, it'd be your house, right?
Trust me, Reggie Yates' house is fucked up.
That's the reason my Reeboks are dirty.
I think that ended that thread of the conversation.
This is where we move on. Do you know, I haven't even really thought about this. So we've got a camera in here, and you might have noticed us make reference to it over the last couple of shows, and this will eventually be seen at some point. And I haven't thought about the fact that people are going to think, what the fuck is happening to Reg? Why does he not even
have we've done so well? How many of these have we done? A few of them. But Trap House is the most accurate.
Well, you don't think I'm not going to go home and tweet, pray for Reg? I'm going to set up a GoFundMe and shit. Like, Reg is looking rough right now, fam. People are like, how is Reggie?
He's good. Like,
boy.
He's looking rough for Reggie.
He's selling
right
old doors.
I'm going to go to Yen and be like, what happened to your boy, fam?
He's got a trap house, man.
He's got a trap house. Man tried to give me work.
I hear fiends scuttering around upstairs. Yeah, no, this doesn't look great. So, I think Trap House is a fitting way to end this. Thank you for giving my friends a joke that they will batter me with for the rest of my life. You're a gentleman and a bastard all at the same time.
Oh, man, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you, man. Like, I really enjoy your work as well, man. So it's nice to actually link up with you, man.
Yeah, listen, I'm a fan of what it is you do, and I'd love to see you live. Are you performing anywhere soon?
Damn, I'm going to be on tour later this year, and all my tour dates are going to be on my website, jamalimaddox.com, and my Instagram, which is also jamalimaddox. And I'm going to be on tour later this year, and I'll be in Edinburgh this year for the month. So I'll be around.
This has been Talk Stew. Thank you so much for listening once again, and we'll see you next time for more stew. Oh, shit. It was going so well. Bye. 5-7 is a Pixie U57 production. Now don't forget, you can hear more bonus content from The Stew on Deezer.com.
Deezer. Originals.